I remember that year, that's the first time in my life that I actually felt scared for our community, because there was just so much shooting going on. There's always rat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat. Kids would sleep in their bathtubs because of stray bullets.
We'll be taking you to the most dangerous neighborhood in the country.
East Palo Alto has more killings per capita than any place in the country.
How did you build a relationship with the gang leaders to actually have them to?
Well, if you can win over and have what I call a trusted relationship with some of the gang members, sometimes it's the key gang member that has the most amount of influence over the others.
So they'll come to you, they will call you, and then they will kind of tell you they're about to do something really bad to someone.
Yeah, and sometimes they're asking for advice, though.
My guest today is Pastor Paul Baines from East Palo Alto, California. Today, he'll share with us how the city of East Palo Alto was able to turn around from being the murder capital of the state and the country to achieving zero homicides.
But a lot of times, believe it or not, the young people wanted discipline. They wanted parameters, because how they grew up, maybe the father wasn't around, or maybe the parents weren't around. Because what discipline does, it does show that you really genuinely care about someone. And I remember one kid was cussing, he was cussing at these girls, and I don't allow cussing, I don't care. And so I said, hey man, we don't do that. And so he said, who are you? You know, you don't tell me what to do, you know, all that. So he got all, and then the other kids came in and said, oh no, you don't talk to Double P like that. And I said, what's Double P? That's Pastor Paul. So that's what they would call me.
I'm Siamai Kurami. Welcome to California Insider.
Pastor Paul, it's great to have you on. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
You know, Pastor, we have been actually covering a lot of California's problems and issues, especially with crime. As the crime has been going up, and some communities are really challenged, like Oakland in certain areas, Stockton, some parts of LA, and we're seeing more gun violence. You're from East Palo Alto, which is a city that has turned things around from being the capital murder of California to now having zero murders. So we want to talk to you about how you guys did it, because a lot of cities probably are going to look into this as time's going by. How did you guys achieve this? Can you tell us?
Well, I would say not only were we the capital state for the murders, but we, per capita, we were actually the murder capital of the United States.
Wow.
So it was even beyond California. And that was back in the 93, 94, 95 era. It was pretty challenging at that time and pretty scary for the residents of our community. But how did we turn it around? Well, it was not one single answer, but many answers, to be honest with you. And as a person of faith, I would say that the faith community really led, if not the effort, a effort, along with the other communities, organizations that we had there. And of course, law enforcement played its role in there. But the faith community was the one that really actually stepped up and partnered with law enforcement, partnered with community-based organizations, and then came out of their four walls, which is what I always tell faith leaders, that you cannot just speak from behind your pulpit, but you need to go outside the four walls, find out what's going on in your neighborhood, and then look at how can we partner with one or two or three organizations in that local area, and then try to take that local area and work in it in a positive way, and not trying to proselytize, but trying to show, you're my neighbor, I care about you, I love you, and I want to help you. And so those are some of the things that we did as far as a strategy. It's about getting to know one another, first and foremost.
So can you, for some of us that haven't lived in an environment like that, can you tell us what was it like to live in East Palo Alto, and what was the community like?
Well, you know, the community, it was really based upon an agricultural community back in the early 40s and what have you. And then you had a lot of African Americans that migrated from San Francisco to the community, and it was like it was the mecca for the Black community in particular at that particular time, earlier on in the 70s. And so you had 90% of the community, they owned their own homes and everything. And it was a beautiful community that were mostly people of color. And then we call that BC, you know, before crack. When the crack started to come into our community, it started to destroy the family structure. The family structure of a father and a mother with their children. And if that father got on drugs, then it just desecrated that family in a myriad of ways, to where they would actually end up losing their own home. And then violence start plaguing our community like never before, to the point where people were scared and nervous. And it wasn't so much the people that were selling the drugs to people in our community, but it was people outside of the community that was coming in to buy the drugs. But then that created turf wars because it was good business. And with the discriminatory type of practices that people didn't want to hire people from East Palo Alto. I remember interviewing or going for a few different jobs, and they would look at my ID and they said, "So are you from East Palo Alto?" And then they would say, "Oh," I would say, "Yes." And then they say, "Okay, thank you, but no thank you." Right, just like that. Because there was not a lot of enforcement of fair practices, at least at that level. That they would adhere to. So I remember those days, and some people would do things, unfortunately, for survival. I don't condone drugs whatsoever. I don't condone theft whatsoever. But I understand why they were doing some of these things. If we had access to jobs and there wasn't these discriminatory laws, I don't think that the drugs would have been so pervasive in the community because I think the elders, particularly the grandmothers, they would help to guide those who were applying for jobs, which would be their grandchildren. So, you know, that's how it kind of started from my perspective and from my point of view.
So essentially, people got addicted in the community. Some people got addicted, and then at the same time, things got bad, so then you couldn't get jobs, right, from East Palo Alto, and then things got worse and worse, and then you had these drug wars at the same time, right?
Yeah. You know, East Palo Alto is basically made up of three different primary territories that we had: the Ville, we had Midtown, and we had the Gardens. And so if you lived in those areas, then you would be warring against the other areas. There's other so-called wannabe gang members that are out there, various names. But those were the three primary areas. And really, this community is only 2.5 square miles. And so it's relatively
a small area, right?
Right, geographical footprint. But the drug dealers, you know, they looked at it as a very lucrative business, just like any drug business, and therefore they want to expand their territories. And so if someone was veering off into what they consider their geographical footprint, then yes, it started a lot of these wars. But ironically, the majority of the shootings and the cause of the violence was not more than 10, 12 families. Out of all the, at that particular time, was roughly 25,000 people in the community. Only 10 to 12 families was causing the majority of 90% of the shootings.
And did people know who they were? Or?
Well, people on the street knew who they were. The cops eventually knew who they were. But the faith community needed to know more who they were. Because we need to go and have those courageous conversations with people. And that's what ended up happening. But at the beginning, I would say sometimes our faith leaders were, I don't want to say they were a little bit scared or nervous or didn't know how to approach it at the very beginning. But eventually we caught on, and not only did we catch on, we, I would say, infiltrated that community to the point where we would talk to them and not talk at them. And we would understand where they were at that particular time and what their needs were. Because sometimes people commit violence, and I don't condone it, but they commit violence as a survival, an act of survival. To steal Similac baby milk and to steal baby diapers, well, that's not a crime that you're, you know, you're going to get rich off. That's a crime that you're trying to take care of your kids because you don't have a job, you don't have income. And so, you know, that's would be the default that some people in our community would default to because they didn't have access to jobs because no one would hire them, whether they had a record or they didn't have a record. Because they were brown or black or Pacific Islander, people didn't want to hire them back in those 90s. We are grateful that my family actually had a trucking company called Baines Moving Services, which is what my brother started back in the 60s. It was a furniture company. Then it turned into a moving company because he was end up moving more furniture than he was selling. People would always call him back. And so we would hire a lot of the people that maybe had a record. They've been in jail or they've been in prison. And so 80% of our hires were people that been in the system, but they had a job. They had income. They were able to, you know, go back to their families and provide for their families, which is what we all wanted to do, you know, take care of our own families with our own resources. And so that was helpful because we were the largest private employer of that particular time in the 80s. Yeah, in the 80s and early 90s.
And what was it for you guys, you know, as you were going through this process of seeing all these crimes and murders, and you said the faith community had to take some risks. What was it like? Can you tell us, and what was those thinking? What were they thinking, and how were they able to get in?
So first and foremost, I'm a person that believes that none of us is as strong as all of us. That's just my philosophy in life, and that we're better together than we are apart. And so meeting with other faith leaders and getting them, first of all, gathering them together. And we're talking about different faiths, different faith traditions. But we come together and talk and pray together. Because if you can pray together, you can stay together. That's my belief. We were called the White Hats. And Dennis Schwartzer was really the originator of White Hats. And we would say, up with hope, down with dope. And we'd be there on Friday and Saturday
just
nights.
Just on the streets.
On the streets. We wear white hats. I still have my white hat to this day. That was around the 95s.
And you would have signs. You would hold signs.
We'd have signs out there, and we would go where the drug deals were being sold on those various corners. And I remember my father at the time, even before the white hats, he would videotape the drug deals because they were on the corners where our church was. And one of the drug dealers said, "Hey, Baines, just want to let you know they got a contract out on you and your father because you are videotaping." So I went back to my father and told him, "Hey, Dad, you know, they got a contract on us. They want us to chill out." And my father's from Texas.
What does the contract mean? Like they wanted to kill you guys?
It means they wanted to shoot us and wow. Put us out, take us out. And my father's from Texas, and he was in the Army. He was a boxer as well. He meant what he said, and he said what he meant. I grew up in a time where my father didn't speak twice to me. his discipline was his discipline of that day and age. But he said, "We're not stopping." And so I went back to the drug dealers. "Hey, Dad said he's not stopping." And so the big drug dealer came over and he ended up just moving them off of those street corners where our church was. Now, where they went, I don't know. I'm sure they didn't stop selling their drugs. They just moved to some other area. But I remember that vividly clear, along with the other things and other tactics that, you know, God led us to do, I would say, to help combat the violence and particularly the drug sales. Some of the other tactics that we did under our We Hope organization, and by the way, We Hope stands for We Help Other People Excel. So we don't care where people came from. We don't care if they were a drug dealer, gang member, or if they're just poor and they have lack resources. Our goal is to try to help them become either self-sufficient or move to that next level of life with the programs and services that We Hope has to offer. And some of the things that we implemented was midnight basketball and midnight soccer. And so we would contact some of the so-called gang leaders and say, hey, you know, you guys got beef, but why don't you consider taking the beef out on the court? Well, some of the gang members like, yeah, okay, we can bring it, you know, because everybody likes competition. And I said, the kicker is no guns. No knives can be brought, and all that stuff can't be there. And so they would show up, whether it was Nortanials, Serranials. We didn't really have Blood and Crips. It was more so those three territories and a bunch of other smaller gangs in our community. And they would show up on Fridays and Saturday nights. I don't know if we did Sunday nights, too. I think we did Sunday nights as well. And, you know, we would start at 11 o'clock at night, 10:30 at night. And they would play soccer and they would play basketball. And it got a little tough, you know, but everyone said, we're gonna abide by the rules. And I remember one kid was cussing, he was cussing at these girls, and I don't allow cussing, I don't care. And so I said, hey man, we don't do that. And so he said, who are you? You know, you don't tell me what to do, you know, all that. So he got all, and then the other kids came in and said, oh no, you don't talk to Double P like that. And I said, what's Double P? That's Pastor Paul. So that's what they would call me. and they intervened on behalf of me. And I said, okay, that was pretty cool. But I want to make sure there was no beef off-site, because a lot of times the beef, it can start one place, but it ends up going forth in another place. So those are just some of the tactics and strategies that we use. And then,
so you would get them to come on Friday and Saturday nights and Sunday nights to come out of their fighting time to come and actually do it and play sports together.
Yeah, and they would they go after each other. You know, you're supposed to be going for the ball, and then they're not going for the ball all the time. And that's some of the part. That's just a part. That's the nature of the beast that we were dealing with.
Before we continue, we would like to thank Shen Yun for sponsoring this channel. It takes you back in time to magical world of ancient China with a unique blend of brilliant dancing, beautiful costumes, and legends coming to life. Go to shenyun.com to find out the schedule and theater information. It's a lifetime experience you don't want to miss.
Just so inspiring. It makes me want to go dance.
Breathtaking.
I was very impressed.
I'm taking my program and I'm going to mention it on the news because I think it's a great performance and people should see it.
What I loved about the show was the authenticity of it. It was taking me on a journey.
Exceptional. The technique involved that. The thousands of hours of training.
People just float. Everything was exact and then they worked to the exact moment and it was beautiful.
You go away feeling with a smile in your heart from it.
Have to come. Life-changing.
Make sure you see it. Make sure you see it.
Don't wait. Get your tickets now.
How did you build a relationship with the gang leaders to actually have them to?
Well, if you can win over and have what I call a trusted relationship with some of the gang members, sometimes it's the key gang member that has the most amount of influence over the others, and they find out that you're legit, because they will test you. They'll might feed you some information to see if you're going to go to law enforcement with it. Well, one of the benefits of being a person of faith, a clergyman, is that I can't be coerced, I can't be forced to testify against anybody because you're telling things to me in confidence. The only way that I'm have to be a mandated reporter is when it could be physical abuse against a senior, or you're a threat to self, or a threat to someone else. Then I'm relieved of, you know, of that confidentiality. And so I would hold things, you know, things that I would hear, not just from gang members, but things I would hear from people in the community. And things I would even hear from cops that maybe have not practiced the right way. And those are things I have to hold because they needed to have a safe place to talk. And once they knew that this was a safe place and that I and others could be considered trusted sources, then that's when the relationships continue to grow. And if you want to make change in any community or in any arena, as far as I'm concerned, change only moves at the speed of trust. So you have to establish that trust level, and otherwise your credibility is not going to be there, and people won't open up to you. And it doesn't have to be a gang member. That could be anything.
So you have to first communicate and then build this trust, and then you can do more.
Yeah, and in some cases, you have to even become vulnerable yourself. You know, things that have challenged you personally in life or in a certain arena and what have you. And when they see that you're keeping it, as the young folks say, 100, then they're like, okay, you're for real. You are for real. Or when you show up at 2:00 in the morning, I remember one girl, her name was Lindsay. She called me at 2:00 and she was bawling. And I know when they call at 2:00 in the morning that usually that's not good news. Because I would get calls either from the police department or a gang person or someone just going through something. It's not just me. It's also the chaplains that I established with our chaplaincy. And she said, Pastor Paul, he has another girlfriend. And so, you know, I was thankful it wasn't a shooting or killing or anything like that. But she, you know, she was just out of high school, or maybe she was in the senior. And I said, this is important, Lindsay. Yes, this is very important. And you know what? We'll definitely talk about this. And she's a young Latino girl. And she was devastated, you know, because she had put her trust in that relationship and what have you. I said, but let's talk about this in the morning, a little bit later. But you have to answer the phone because you don't know what's going down. Because sometimes it could have been a gang member, which have called and says, hey, man, I'm about to take him out. I'm just letting you know. So, you know, pray for me that that when I take him out, you know, I'm able to get away. Well, I'm not going to pray for that. You know, I don't pray for violence. Yeah. But it gives me and others
a chance
to talk to them. And that's what some of them really wanted.
Did this happen to multiple times?
Oh, yeah. We've had that happen. I would say it hasn't happened more than, well, with me, it definitely hasn't happened more than 8 or 9 times throughout that whole years. But I don't know how many of the other chaplains or pastors or faith leaders it happened to. I'm sure it did.
So they will come to you, they will call you, and then they will kind of tell you they're about to do something really bad to someone.
And sometimes they were asking for advice, though. But a lot of times, believe it or not, the young people wanted discipline. They wanted parameters because how they grew up, maybe the father wasn't around or maybe the parents weren't around. And there was no one setting those guidelines for them. Because what discipline does, it does show that you really genuinely care about someone. You know, yeah, there are those that like, man, get out my face with that. Yeah, there's many of those situations that occurred. But in all actuality, they really wanted those guidelines. They wanted someone that cared enough about them to tell them that what they're doing is wrong. And so, you know, we were able to establish various programs through We Hope and other organizations like, Live in Peace was another organization, One East Palo Alto. These are other organizations that were youth-serving organizations that really impacted our community. So like I was saying earlier, it wasn't just one solution. It's a multiple solution approach. It's just that the faith-based community and basically those two organizations had faith leaders in them that also would use faith as a component to solve the problems.
As you know, in California Insider, we've been covering a lot of the problems California is facing, and we have a lot of challenges and problems. While we are covering these problems, you should also note that we have people like Pastor Paul that are in our community that are trying to make the communities better. While we might have more gangs and more crimes, as things get more challenging for certain areas in California, there are going to be leaders that come, rise up from the community and shine. So we want to make sure you keep that in mind. We also want to make sure that you understand that a lot of times our guests are these heroes that are coming to actually do good things for the community, and they're highlighting the problems and they want to solve these problems that we're facing as a community. You also should check out our interview with Gil Tejeda, who was a former gang member, who actually explained to us how gangs work, how you can tell if they're in your community and they're growing or they're dying. He also can tell you what the gang mindset is.
I'm a former gang member. I also did about 6 years in the California Youth Authority, so I was that guy out there carrying the guns in the neighborhood, right? When I joined the gang, I was 14 years old. When you're a child in a gang environment like that and you get into a gang, you're aspiring to become somebody in prison. You want to. That's our goal. Our goal is literally to go to prison, and we think that's like we went to Harvard. That's the mindset. But it just, first it was generational, and it wasn't so much brainwashing as we were very uneducated. We didn't know any better. We were still kind of in the tribal sense and thinking this is the right thing to do.
Make sure to click on the link below and watch this episode. It's free on our website.
Now, do you have some examples or stories of people that were like these gang leaders, or if they were very involved with the gangs and then gradually they kind of stopped?
Well, one of the people that we brought onto our team in the We Hope, his name was Joshua Mason. And there was a couple other ones too. So we had one white guy, one Pacific Islander, one Latino, and one black. Because we want to make sure we cover, you know, because that was
where. Because that's.
And it wasn't a lot of white people in our community, but Joshua was a former gang member. He was out of San Quentin. And so our Pelican Bay, excuse me, because Pelican Bay is above San Quentin when you come in. When you look at the hierarchy of where orders come from. He was extremely instrumental, along with others, at reaching out, because he was a former gamer. He was a former shooter. He served his time for the dirt that he did, and others as well. And so you enlist them and you learn from them, because I wasn't a gang member. You know, have I did my